War-torn Sudan is facing a looming famine and the world's largest displacement crisis as the conflict between rival militaries that started last April grinds on and the situation deteriorates on the ground. UN News' Khaled Mohammed spoke with Justin Brady, who leads the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in the country. Speaking from Port Sudan, where most aid agencies are now based, Mr. Brady warned that the images starting to come out from some areas are reminiscent of the worst of any famine we have seen elsewhere. He also outlined the tense situation in Al-Fashir and other hotspots around the country, stressing that we're in a race against time, but the time is running out.
We've struggled with three main issues. That's access, that's resources, and that's attention, in order to respond to what are the biggest problems. And those problems, as you mentioned, displacement, the largest displacement problem in the world. Sudan, we need to remember, came into this conflict in a bad way. There was a coup after the revolution. That coup took place in October of 21. That cut off most development funding from most major international donors. The economy was in shambles. There was sporadic ethnic violence, and we still had a very large displaced population. That displaced population, if we look at overall before and now since the conflict, is around 10 million. And we have over 2 million Sudanese who have fled the country. Those that have remained, especially in the conflict areas of Darfur, Khartoum, and the Kordofan states, are experiencing extreme hunger conditions. And we do have a warning of famine. We're waiting for the latest food security results to come. We came into the year with 4.9 million people in category four, IPC four. That's where you really have exhausted all coping mechanisms. And those, we're likely to see a large percentage of that to be in IPC five. That's famine. Malnutrition. Close to a million children with severe acute malnutrition. And then the protection concerns. This war has been brutal in terms of human rights abuses, gender and sexual-based violence, and there's really no place for the people to go. So unfortunately, we have the full gambit of concerns, and the tools that we have to deal with it are quite limited in the midst of what is an ongoing conflict.
You spoke about hunger and the imminent famine. What could be the most shocking scenes and situations you have witnessed firsthand or heard from humanitarian colleagues, partners, or local communities?
Yeah, in the absence of new data, which, as I said, will be coming very shortly, we do rely on anecdotal evidence. And that's when we started to get news of people eating leaves off of trees. There was even one story of a mother cooking up dirt just to put something in her children's stomach. The images are starting to come out from some areas that are reminiscent of the worst of any famine we have seen elsewhere. There are anecdotal evidence of increased mortality and graves in various places. So those are unfortunately becoming a more constant reminder of where we stand, but also right here in Port Sudan, where we have access to see children who are malnourished. And that comes down to the lack of resources that we have had. Until recently, we have been waiting on pledges from the Paris conference that took place on the 1 year anniversary of the conflict, 15 April. Of 2.2 billion announced, 868 million might be for humanitarian action in Sudan. I say might because some of it seems to be recycled pledges or funds that were already allocated. On the 15th of April, we only had 6% of the funds we required for this year. We're now up to almost 17%. That is still a very meager amount. I have been involved in two famine prevention operations in Somalia, and it's something you can't do on the cheap. And we're very happy for the United States' recent announcement of an additional $315 million for Sudan. And there's other funding that is coming from those pledges in In Paris. So we should be over 30%. The question is, how long does it take for that money to come into the system, for it to be transferred, and to translate into actual operations? Because there's always a lag time. So the quicker that money gets in, the more chance we have to actually address the concerns that are out there.
If we talk more about the situation in Darfur, how far is it deteriorating, particularly in and around El Fasher in northern Darfur?
Yeah, this is really what is capturing the attention right now is the siege of El Fasher, the largest city in Darfur, the capital of North Darfur. Over 800,000 people residing there prior to the conflict, at least that many. Figures are always a little difficult here in Sudan when it comes to population. But the reports we have is just constant pressure on those who have remained. Many have fled, but it is not depopulated, as some would say. And those civilians are caught up in that attack by the RSF, the defense of the city being done by not only the SAF, the Sudan Armed Forces, but also forces from various groups in Darfur who were part of the Juba peace agreement. And unfortunately, we don't see that letting up. There's been a lot of efforts to negotiate a local ceasefire, but no results on that. And the situation gets worse. Most notably, the attack on Southern Hospital, the main health facility in the city, which has now been rendered essentially unusable. There's very little place for these people to go. In addition to El Fasher, though, we have to remember we've got hotspots as far as the conflict goes across the country. The situation in northern Khartoum of Durman remains very, very contested. We have an ongoing offensive by the SAF to retake Wad Madani, the capital of Al Jazeera state, which was lost in December. And we have fighting around El Obeid in North Kordofan, where is really a key transit center for supplies to reach cross line into Darfur. And therefore, we're having a lot of trouble with access because of the physical barrier of conflict itself.
Speaking of those hotspots, are humanitarian workers able to reach those spots right now?
In many cases, no. And it hasn't been that case. We do have some partners working there, local NGOs. Some of the international NGOs have remained, or they remain with their national staff. But as we saw with El Fasher, when it gets too hot, that it's not possible to operate. It's best to take our staff out of harm's way so that they are still with us and able to jump back in when the possibility is there. We are looking right now at staging supplies and response around El Fasher that will be ready to deploy once there is an opening to do so, and also to catch up where those who have fled the city are going to. We are looking at something that is quite urgent, which is the oncoming seasonal rains. And that is going to make movements in many parts of the country difficult, if not impossible. So really, we're in a race against time, as we keep saying, but the time is running out to pre-position stocks and to move. And unfortunately, with conflict, it isn't possible to necessarily foresee how that is all going to play out.
How did the humanitarian community working in Sudan receive the latest resolution adopted by the UN Security Council demanding that all parties to the conflict ensure the protection of civilians and allow unhindered and sustained passage of humanitarian relief for civilians in need?
Yeah, these have been constant calls. We've certainly welcomed the continued pressure from the international community. As I said at the outset of this interview, we have struggled with attention. That's attention from international policymakers. That's attention from the media who have had themselves had difficulty entering the country to document what is happening. Thankfully, they are getting in now and can tell the story. Yeah, unfortunately, if we go back to the Jeddah process in May, that is Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, a process facilitated by Saudi Arabia and the United States, as well as the Intergovernmental Body on Development for East Africa. These are similar to what has been pledged by both sides and has not necessarily translated on the ground. On the SAF side, the free movement of supplies, I should note, and I have to note, that has changed considerably in the last 6 to 7 weeks We have seen a sort of a 180-degree shift by the government as far as facilitating, and we're very happy to see that and allowing us to get there again in the short timeframe we have before the rains. And then on the protection of civilians, the protection of humanitarian workers and supplies, the RSF has consistently said the right things, but on the ground that has not translated to action. So we need more than just a resolution. We need actual active diplomacy, pressure on the parties that are supporting them in order to bring this mindless war to an end.
Moving to another alarming issue, allegations of rape, forced marriages, sexual slavery, and trafficking of women and girls continue to be recorded. Can you tell us more about this and what type of support the UN provides to the victims and survivors?
Yeah, this continues to be reported. The problem, once again, is not having access, not having people on the ground to be there to report these issues. Certainly, sexual-based violence, not unlike other countries, is a huge stigma in Sudan. And there are more reports we're getting from the UNFPA of even the survivors of that committing suicide. Because it is a very heavy burden to bear within Sudanese society. So again, where are these taking place? Principally in areas under RSF control are the reports that we have. They have continued to deny they are perpetrating those, but if they're not perpetrating it, they are allowing the conditions for that to happen. And they need to take responsibility for that. So we'll continue to try and provide services to survivors, but when we talk about the lack of funding, the funding we do have is principally geared toward four main areas: food, health, water sanitation and hygiene, as well as nutritional supplies. So when we start talking about survivor assistance, when we talk about shelter, when we talk about protection, mine action, we have a large accumulation of unexploded ordnance, explosive remnants of war in the country. We're seeing a much lower level of funding for those areas of work. So even if we see the overall total of funding go up, it masks some of the large deficits that some of these other very important areas of work are dealing with. Education right now, there are 19 million children in this country who really have not been able to go to school for over a year, and it doesn't look good going forward. There have been attempts by various states in the north and the east of the country to restart schooling. The main example of that is River Nile State, which began back in November. But we're seeing not just today lost for the Sudanese people, but tomorrow.
Finally, UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, is visiting Sudan this week. What's on the agenda of this visit?
Yeah, and this is his second visit this year. And it's always very encouraging to have a principal of his level and also his stature and reputation to visit, highlighting the situation of refugees. We talk a lot about the displaced in Sudan. We don't really hear much about the plight of refugees from Sudan and neighboring countries, where the response is equally low, if not lower, due to a lack of resources, as well as the refugees that are in Sudan. Sudan had long been a country that was open to hosting refugees in the region from countries that were experiencing conflict and other problems themselves. And those refugees have been caught up in this war just like everyone else. However, they don't have a social safety net of any kind. We had a discussion with a group of refugees here in Port Sudan who had been displaced from Khartoum, a very emotional discussion, as the gentleman broke down in tears and just simply said, "You've left us here to die." But again, where are the resources for that in order to provide support? Again, in a place where we have access. These are the troubling things for myself and my colleagues to wake every day knowing we can make a difference if we had the tools at our disposal.